Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 76, section 3. We got into this section a little ways. I'll tell you the paragraph in a second. It's old single column, page 850. It's the sixth paragraph. After that large paragraph break that starts Adam's Caravan. So recall what we got up to. They were sort of completing mainly the elements that have some parallel in the Genesis story, taking you up, pointing out that some of those individuals in the genealogies there, at least at the beginning, are actually are being remembered historically. They aren't just fillers to get you from Adam to Noah, you know, and with a hop, skip, and a jump. So we're going through that. We went through the Cain and Abel story. We were looking at that, what seems quite suspiciously, anyway, to be an understanding of why you got such a profound phenomenon that in the Revelation they call the Sethite priesthood, such a profound phenomenon that it actually gets remembered in the Genesis story, not literally as a Sethite priesthood, you know, but that when you get to Enos and Kenan, it says that, you know, the humans began to call upon the name of the Lord. Okay? You know, and so that whole trying to awaken a religious nature that could prevent, you know, what seems to be what happened there most likely when Abel was killed and he didn't have an adjuster yet. And we talked about that quite a bit. Before we, you know, we transition here, you know, that large paragraph break that we stopped at is because they're sort of transitioning into the tale of that immediate story, how it feeds into the Violet race going forward. So, but before we leave those issues with Cain and Abel and what appears to be the immediate consequences of that cataclysm behind, when we were talking about the little between the lines hints about that issue, you know, it seemed to be highly suggestive that that's what the deal was with Abel. Towards the end there, I mean, it's right at the top of page 850 in the single column, but in that two paragraphs back from where we're going to start, remember how they said that Seth was born 129 years after Adam's arrival on Urantia, and we were talking about that a little bit, and I was adding that to the mix about these issues that seem to be suggesting Adam and Eve recognizing that they needed to back off from what appears to be kind of an initial, it's like, okay, so the worst is behind us. Yeah, they took away almost all our kids to Adentia. Okay, but we're gonna make a fresh start. You know, between the Tigris and Euphrates, we're gonna conceive Abel, and we're gonna get things going. But all these things seem to have sobered him up a little bit, you know, and trying to remind him, it was that getting ahead of yourself thinking that brought the problems in the first place. You know, that impatience and that over-idealization of the situation. But I was talking to that in these number of different ways, and when I brought in what's relevant about the 129 years after Adam's arrival, I was speaking in a very just how that feeds into the truth of that issue. I wasn't specifically trying to focus in, you know, analytically on the timeline. You know, so I was speaking in not so linear terms, but in kind of more nonlinear terms. And after the group, it was pointed out that, you know, the way I said things could easily, people could take it off on a false tangent, as if I was saying that somehow Seth wasn't born until after Abel was killed. Okay. And that definitely is not the case, because, you know, so let's just take a moment and look at that, you know, that timeline a little bit. So if Seth is born 129 years after Adam's arrival, that means he's born 12 years after the default. The default was 117 years. Okay, so you've got 12 years, and I think we mentioned that last week. You know, so you just have 12 years. Obviously, that's, you know, a smaller number than 18. Okay, no matter where, you know, where we put the birth in here precisely. But, you know, then think about, you know, Abel. So, you know, remember we were talking about how, you know, so obviously Cain's conception starts the default, and you know, it appears that they basically went in the full no delay mode, you know, and there's a year of nursing Cain, and then immediately Adam and Eve, you know, Eve is getting pregnant, you know, right away with Abel, and 9 months later he's born. So you have Abel being born 2.5 years after the default. You know, one year chunk and 2 9-month chunks. Okay. You know, so just 2.5 years after the default, and Seth is born 12 years after the fall. Okay. You know, so yeah, obviously Seth is not being born after Abel's killed. Okay, but the thing that, you know, that I was bringing up there is, you know, there's, as we were talking, they seem to be very much, let's get right back to having babies again, because who knows how long we're going to be here. Things can happen. You know, we're mortal now. We need to get as many violet rays as possible. It seemed like they definitely had that thought, how they immediately, had Abel. But, you know, and so you could say, well, okay, maybe you could imagine once they actually kind of got into the garden a little bit and really wrapped their mind around just how much work it was going to be to build that great big wall, you know, and set up, you know, a little settlement and stuff. Okay, you think, well, maybe they okay, let's just take a little break here before we, you know, have the next one. You could imagine maybe there was a logistics thing that might have slowed it down a little bit. But, okay, that's a lot of years before Seth is born. And so the point I was trying to make is you think about how the truth of what's flowing through those actions, how it might feed into them, recognizing that, you know, Abel died without an adjuster, is, you know, almost, apparently in very short order, they started recognizing, as I was saying last week, you know, I think we need to get some structure built up here. You know, apparently it's set in pretty quickly that they were going to delay because they could recognize that it was just too unstructured and it was inappropriate to be bringing pure line children, you know, which are supposed to be raised in that very controlled, setting, you know, in the first garden, right? They don't have anything like here, so to bring them in without that controlled setting, and you know, so you could think maybe it's just that to begin with is delaying it a little bit, but then they're seeing the dynamics between Cain and Abel, you know, even when they're young, how people are reacting to Cain, you know, the other people in the group, you know, and they're thinking, you know, so you just, the spirit of that it's building up to a problem was probably there, see, and leading to them delaying quite a few years there before they went ahead with Seth. You know, that's what I was trying to get at. Without going into all that detail of the timeline that I just did, right? But just to get at the truth of, you know, of how that spoke to it, right?
Well, they had kids that we would recognize they have never had kids like this before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had had well-mannered, adjusted, normal kids.
Right.
You know.
Right, these kids are, you know, have environmental, you know, tweaking, and they're acting out. They're, you know, they're not handling their sixth adjutant very well to begin with. You know, they're not passive little animals. You know, it's they're difficult to manage. So I just wanted to, if anyone was left with, you know, a confusion. If you go back and listen, you can see how I was just not focusing down on that linear thing, you know, but if you were thinking linearly about what I was saying, it would be confusing. And leaving that specific thing aside, recognize that's something that the more that you get into recognizing the truth, let's say specifically of the revelation, you always have this challenge when you're speaking to someone, if you're thinking in a very holistic, nonlinear way and recognizing what's going on, as you try to give words about that, you have to make sure that they're kind of getting into that nonlinear space with you too, and they aren't still thinking in a very material-dominated linear temporal mode, because they won't understand what you're trying to say. They'll misunderstand what you're trying to say. So it just struck me as I thought about that, without even thinking about that, I was just staying up in that kind of nonlinear space, and it led to this confusion. And there's a number of places in the book where, that sometimes the revelations actually even point that out. It's like, okay, you're going to think about this in a very linear temporal way. We'll do our best to kind of meet you where you are and as you are, but fundamentally what we're talking about isn't well suited to that. It'd be better if you could think in more nonlinear terms. But then there's other times when they don't remind you like that. So if you're struggling with some passage in the book, step back and ask yourself, am I trying to cram it into a one-dimensional universe here? Do I need to back off a little bit and think in bigger terms? And not be so mechanical, in my approach to what's being said to me. So it's something to just remind yourself in general.
Grind up the grains of truth.
We're not trained
to tell it to other people in the beginning.
Yeah, we're not trained like this anymore. You know, our society, even in the college level, doesn't do this anymore. So it's important for you just to remind yourself. You got that challenge. You know, it's not your run of the mill story that you're reading. It often is challenging you very aggressively to think relative to the truth and not just dot to dot with the words of the book. Okay, so now back to...
I wonder if Abel, if it hadn't been for Cain and his issues, if Abel probably wouldn't have... He probably... I'm thinking it was a two-sided thing. It wasn't just Abel.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. As we pointed out, I mean, it was a complicated setting. Remember, I was mentioning it's not like the story is told in the Bible, right? Where it's very biased to the herders that are telling the story. In many ways, Abel's has issues, but okay, Cain has some issues too. Sure. So the Bible story isn't totally. Biased against him unfairly, right? But it's a complicated story, and again, you're to get you back to what I was saying at the very end about that final paragraph we read that starts out the Sethite priesthood there. I remember I was pointing out how that feeds into to establish the nature of Hebrew religious conception. You know, the flavor of what you see in the Old Testament, and why it has so much about health and all these other cultural things and whatnot. If it is the case that that Abel's death without an adjuster was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back on everyone recognizing just how important it was to establish some definitive religious mission, what if Abel hadn't been killed? What if there hadn't been that final exclamation point? Would there have been a Sethite priesthood? And if there hadn't been a Sethite priesthood, it's not just the Hebrews, but all of mankind would have been in a very much more primitive state religiously. Could you have even gotten things to the state where you could have Jesus come to this world, Michael come to this world?
Melchizedek might have to come earlier.
Or no matter how much they tried, or even if they're,
you never know.
See, you can go back and you can see. Remember, in supremacy, there are no coincidences. So, you can start to wonder: does this all just work? So that there's a Sethite priesthood. There's a Melchizedek, and there's Melchizedek missionaries. There's a spiritual quickening in the 6th century BC. And when all is said and done, it's just enough. So that it can work in this very abnormal, minimal way that Michael doing his, doing a bestowal mission prior to a magisterial mission and all this, and that can all somehow work out in the end, right? It can all hinge on, when you follow it back, coincidentally, Abel died, when you get to supremacy, everything will be like that, right? You'll go back, oh yeah, coincidentally, Bob was killed by a truck that day, and therefore, it all plays together in the end. It's not that it's predestined, but remember, there's a...
Yeah, the famous frog leap.
Right. It's just, there's this conspiratorial, quote-unquote, over-control, right? There's the supreme mind that's taking all these facts, right? And so they all end up conspiring together in this very interesting way, so... Right, and I'm just stressing that because eventually they're going to bring that up too, right? Once we get to Adam and Eve, kind of thinking about these messages they're getting, it's like Michael's going to come, and right, they start thinking maybe this isn't, the most benighted world. Maybe the evolutionary process is going to make lemonade out of lemons. Right? Which, of course, that's what I'm saying. It always does. It always will. But when you look at it, in retrospect, you go, oh, well, coincidentally, that individual went to iniquity, so their adjuster became a supreme adjuster, which initiated the process where eventually that adjuster could be Michael's adjuster, and all that stuff conspires together, right, to make the story work. So you can just, be more, let it be, let these things just be as they will. All right, so let's get back to, they're going to give us a few more details about what our transplanted Adamic culture here is like in the second garden and how that feeds into an Andite phenomenon going forward from there. Okay.
Adam's caravan had carried the seeds and bulbs of hundreds of plants and cereals of the first garden with them to the land between the rivers. They also had brought along extensive herds and some of all the domesticated animals. Because of this, they possessed great advantages over the surrounding tribes. They enjoyed many of the benefits of the previous culture of the original garden.
Okay. So, one of the things between the lines there that no wonder we, you know, have a lot of domesticated hybrid whatnot things going forward to the present time. It didn't all get lost in the first garden. You know, it got a lot of that got transplanted and fed forward. So, domesticated plants and animals in various ways, if you will. Just, you know, the immediate thing there, just nutrition. You know, one of the things they're pointing out between the lines. Just the fact that they have a higher grade nutrition than the run-of-the-mill tribe makes a huge difference. Right? They're well-fed in quantity and quality. And so many other tribes are trying to scratch out a living. With a stick in the hard dirt. So it made a big difference. And, you know, so between the fear of Adam and his crew by the neighboring tribes, and then the fact that if there is any problems, they're in better physical shape to handle it. That's how it can go forward. You got a thought?
Oh, I'm just thinking about their height.
Oh, yeah.
Their physical size.
Yeah, and the height is going to be, you know, above, you know, many. Yeah, we all know there's the giant strains, and there are Noddites, you know, so there is some height, you know. But still, right, it's there's a lot of things going for them. And they all have, you know, as they mentioned, you know, they all have that adjuster so that what they have naturally, you know, has a super conscious influence imposed upon it, that just brings what they have genetically to a little better focus. It gets applied just a little bit better than if they didn't have an adjuster. So it all in all, they're a people to be reckoned with. And, you know, and like I said, we're heading towards the Andites, just penetrating to the four corners of the earth because of this incredible nature and drive, you know, this directionization of a place like evolutionary people. And it comes from the Adamites. Did you have something?
Okay. Yeah, what hit me was extensive herds. No wonder it took them a year.
Yeah.
Hard to move that many people, and then before, remember,
just to feed all those herds going across the desert like that and stuff. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and then they could, and even if they had a couple of boats, remember they said,
yeah, right. Yeah,
by the way, they were going to take all those people.
With. Right, they didn't have an ark. Yeah. Yes,
they would need more than one ark.
Yeah.
So that's quite an undertaking, actually. If you think.
Yep. Yeah, and getting all that across the Euphrates.
Huh.
Right. They've got to get all. You know, they don't just take the big, you know, 4-lane bridge across the Euphrates. They got to get all this stuff across the Euphrates. Right. Yeah, big logistics task. You know? But anyway, but they managed to do it so that you haven't lost that nucleus of civilization, right? That allows you to go to the store and buy all those cool grains and stuff, right? That go back to Adam and Eve.
Not anymore. They go to Monsanto.
Yeah.
All right. Up to the time of leaving the first garden, Adam and his family had always subsisted on fruits, cereals, and nuts. On the way to Mesopotamia, they had, for the first time, partaken of herbs and vegetables. The eating of meat was early introduced into the second garden, but Adam and Eve never partook of flesh as a part of their regular diet. Neither did Adamson nor Eveson nor the other children of the first generation of the first garden become flesh eaters.
So again, we're reminded of it's not just Adam and Eve that have a higher genetic nature, but that first generation you're seeing here, you know, is still a cut above the run of the mill evolutionary stock. And that it's not, it starts out, here, it's not just, I don't eat things with eyes, right? It's not something like that, right? It's literally the fact that they're not getting the energy input from the master physical controllers. They have to modify their diet. They don't have to eat meat because they're, they genetically don't need that. But they needed to add some herbs and vegetables to make up for the loss of what the master physical controllers used to be feeding into them. Right? And then after the first generation, things blend in, except for, obviously, and they're going to bring that up eventually, this vegetarian diet, has a strong, lasting cultural influence. And it's not just the Adamites, the Nadites had that some too. And so that's why you have, a vegetarian diet feeding into the modern age, from antiquity. And again, it goes back to these genetically different individuals that didn't need meat like evolutionary stock did.
If they hadn't failed, would this have been a trajectory of how we would have eaten more superiorly?
No, again, if
they had...
I'm sure there would have been an even bigger influence on vegetarianism. As an ism, right? But that's the thing. They this isn't an ism for them. That's the point we're trying to make.
It's a superior way to eat. That's what I'm wondering.
Well, remember the only reason that mankind got started. Remember, as they were telling the story, is the ones that failed are the ones that weren't meat eaters. Remember
how
if they had succeeded, long term, not just after all the genetic uplift, but all the subsequent genetic engineering. You can speculate that maybe when a world is settled in light and life, normally the genetically meat is not a requirement.
We're headed that way now. You can get almost all the nutrition's.
Right, yeah, we certainly figured out a lot of the chemistry, and we can, right, we can kind of, but... there's still people that recognize that you're fighting against some, at least for some individuals especially, you're fighting against some genetic limitations of how well a vegetarian diet works for some people, even with all of our chemical understanding of substitutes and these sorts of things. See, and again, that's what I'm trying to get at. Don't think so much in terms of clever knowledge of chemistry and substituting, or ideologies, isms, right? Just think in more, genetic, natural terms that their bodies didn't need protein from meat, right, or the other things from meat, that was so essential in the evolutionary stock to differentiate it from animal stock, and eventually... Right, you don't have to have clever chemical substitutes or anything like that. All that chemistry will be of no use way in the future because we'll be different genetically after we've radically re-engineered ourselves genetically, in our enlightened life. So just
and on how they say nothing is afraid of being, killed or eaten.
Right, see, and it just reminds you.
It is a trajectory eventually.
Right, remember, we've talked about this. See, the flip side of that is, that when you're strolling through the gardens of Edentia, even with all of the menagerie of animals, right, that they have, and even things that, are kind of sort of plant and animal and whatnot, all that, you don't get eaten by a carnivore as you're strolling through the beautiful gardens of Edentia. Right? There aren't any carnivores. We've talked about this. It's like, so does that mean eventually, right, there are no carnivores on any world when a world is settled in light and life? And the humans aren't carnivores either? And there aren't any animal carnivores, right, that all of the beautiful big carnivores are gone? I mean, how natural is that? Do they naturally die off because the creative mother spirit is no longer supporting them and they just die off? I mean, how much is that managed by the people on a world that, you know, they're just kind of managed out of existence? Right. We all know how much tension we have with such thoughts right now. You know, we'll move heaven and earth to try to save the lowliest species. You know, if you have to spend $1 trillion to save this little slug, you know, we'll do it. You know, we think very existentially about species, you know, which, of course, is ridiculous relative to the evolution. You know, almost everything died in the Permian extinction. So we have a lot of, you know, a lot of thinking about all that going forward into the future. You know, what becomes of all the mighty cats and stuff? Right?
Yeah, well, I think they put the qualifier in here, which is as a part of their regular diet.
Oh, yeah.
Every now and then, maybe they taste?
Yeah, I mean, see, again, that just reminds you, this isn't an ism.
Okay.
Right, this isn't a religious thing, right, where it's sacrilege, right? It's, like I said, it's just a practical issue, you know. You know, any more than something you might eat, you don't eat for dietary reasons. You eat because just, you know, it's a tasty little tidbit, right? okay. You know, and I'm trying, and I'm not trying to offend any ismists, but it's just, I'm just trying to remind you, we're fraught with all kinds of isms, and we have to be more objective about it. Okay.
The Adamites greatly excelled the surrounding peoples in cultural achievement and intellectual development. They produced the third alphabet and otherwise laid the foundations for much that was the forerunner of modern art, science, and literature. Here in the lands between the Tigris and the Euphrates, they maintained the arts of writing, metalworking, pottery making, and weaving, and produced a type of architecture that was not excelled in thousands of years.
So you see, each one of these, like I've been saying, I mean, it's just each paragraph is this one little vignette setting up why it is that when you get to the dawn of recorded history, you have these interesting threads, you know, of, you know, sophisticated food stocks and, you know, and domesticated animals and language and architecture and weaving and right, you know, we're, you know, all of that, you know, was yeah, sure, it was being put into place way back with the prince's staff, but, you know, mostly it was lost. But, you know, it was lost in a relatively, it was reestablished after that loss. It was reestablished in a relatively indelible way by Adam and Eve so that it feeds forward through all of the you know, the backing and forthing of the Andites into recorded history. Right, that's what they're just giving you little reminders of each of those things. You know, where, you know, like, you know, where did the Sumerians get this stuff? Right, to be specific, for instance, they got it going back to now the second garden seed, basically. You know, a lot of the first garden gets lost, you know, in the mists of storytelling. And it really all just becomes the second garden that the stories are hearkening back to, our current mythological stories. Third alphabet. Does anyone remember the first two? Who started the first alphabet? It's easy to guess. Right. The prince's staff. No. Fad started the first alphabet. Fad. right, so the first alphabet, remember, had 25 letters, so in that, but that one was lost, and then Van and Amadon, you know, had developed the Andonic tongue, into a more sophisticated language. You know, it had an alphabet of 24 letters that they had constructed for that. But notice that immediately we are tossing out that second alphabet from the first garden and establishing a third alphabet. And that might strike you as kind of strange. Like, why? Well, why couldn't you just keep the alphabet from a couple years before going? Right? We're not that many years hence here. Why are we immediately setting up a different alphabet? Well, you know, it probably has a lot of similarities to the second alphabet. But the why of needing a third alphabet, that just it's reminding you that you have a different group of people that you're going to coordinate together and sort of solidify a definitive language for, right? You need different letters for different modes of expression. You're going to be blending more other people's right away than you were in the first garden mode of how they were going to do things. This third alphabet C is kind of facing evolutionary fact more. It's going to be less of a revelatory alphabet, if you will, right? Something that you kind of put above and the people rise up to it, as opposed to now we just need to, you know, let go and go down to where the people are and just make an alphabet there, okay? And so that's, you know, what you got. But the fact was, you know, there were 24 and 25, right? I mean, it's not, you know, Greek, current Greek has 24 you know, letters in the alphabet. We have 26, right? I mean, why are they based, you know, somewhere in that ballpark? It goes all the way back to Dalmatia.
Well, alphabets are about phonetics. So I guess maybe it's shifting the phonetics or according to people, how they...
Right.
How their mind is.
Right, yeah. We know, we've talked about how, you know, the different Sangic, you know, each of the Sangic stocks has a different language consciousness because they have a different favoritism for the adjutants and all that stuff, right? Feeds into, you know, do you need one of the letters to be a TH, you know, or not? Right? Do you have a theta like they have in Greek or not? Like we, you know, we don't have a TH letter in English. We have a T, N, and H, right? Right? But we don't literally have a TH letter. You know, stuff like that.
It's suggested elsewhere in the book, but the letters are individual, and so this is individuality is being established maybe by the material uplifters in a more definitive way. You know, language is an associative process or mm-hmm. a reading. Mm-hmm. And somehow the Andonites were probably limited in this respect.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like they needed a new, firmer establishment with individuality
yeah.
that the violet race had by nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So there's, yeah. See, just just think of, again why, you know, the why of the third alphabet. You can reflect on that and figure it out. It's not. It's like, well, we're just going to change everything because we want to make everyone forget the first garden. You know, I mean, it's not going to. It's going to be they're going to be practical reasons. It's not going to be some ideological thing, right? You know, and we just sort of, we have such a tendency to treat everything ideologically these days. That's why I was stressing this, trying to remind you, just these are practical issues that are in play. You know?
Slightly less, but we can also imagine that remnants of the previous alphabets could still be in play. Because my hang-up on this would be like, again, the Han culture mm-hmm. might have a holdover of a pictorial second mm-hmm. alphabet.
Yeah.
Or even first, that they then can translate the new concepts into, but... I just want to clarify, we're not talking about a top-down, this is the new alphabet that suddenly everyone...
No, I tried to stress that. I mean, you know, I'm sure this third alphabet had a lot of similarities to the second alphabet, right? in the same way that our, you know, the Phoenician alphabet has similarities going back to these, right? I mean, again, because it's, you just have this, you know, but that evolution of alphabets, you know, had a revelatory initiation. Yeah. You know, and so it just, you know, you've got this contrast between it being kind of biased to the revelation side with the second alphabet, and probably you see biased a little bit more to the evolution side of the second, you know, a little less putting, you know, some, like I said, putting something above there and having everyone work up to it. I'm sure that second alphabet was still trying to be quite a bit in that mode, you know, sort of a challenge, you know, that you're putting everyone to rise up to. Like you're trying to get everyone to rise up biologically and everything. Now it's much more, okay, this is, you know, nothing's going to go up very fast. Okay, we need to kind of meet people much more where they are. We need to adapt this alphabet, you know, a little bit, so it's a little bit more evolutional in construct. Okay. The details, you know, you can let linguists, you know, speculate on going forward in the future. But okay, anyway, right. So just, you know, maybe one little thing to note about in the list there, you know, writing, metalworking, pottery making, weaving. You know, the metalworking one, you know, that was a tough one to hold on to. You know, that was lost in many ways and had to be rediscovered, you know. So we think of, you know, now we're in the Bronze Age, finally. You know, now we're in the Iron Age, finally. You know, but actually, you know, way back, okay, they were, you know, they had steel and stuff, okay. And all that was forgotten. But, you know, weaving, you know, and pottery making, those held in there, you know. I mean, there wasn't such a drop-off, you know, and then a subsequent evolutionary rediscovery with those, you know, and you go to the Andites in northern China in very ancient times, and one of the most striking things is their weaving. They've got this sophisticated weaving, you know. Where did that come from? It comes from here, right? Those Andites have carried forward that sophisticated weaving from the Second Garden, you know, and they're teaching yellow man in China it, you know. Oh, so many millennia subsequently. Okay.
The home life of the Violet peoples was, for their day and age, ideal. Children were subjected to courses of training in agriculture, craftsmanship, and animal husbandry, or else were educated to perform the threefold duty of a Sethite, to be priest, physician, and teacher.
So there you see the pithy little summary of the Sethite that we were talking about at the end of last week, priest, physician, teacher. All right, so it isn't just priests, and so that's why the Old Testament is complicated, you know, with stuff blended into the religion there that isn't really religion. But here you see what I was talking about. See, they've got this corrected. They've got the structure now. They've got this clamped down appropriately. So that, you know, the 41 children that they give birth to, you know, Seth and, you know, subsequent to Seth, you know, after Abel, are being raised in enough structure to handle, you know, that more activated sixth adjutant that you've got in a young person with higher biology. Right, you have to actually manage that more, and that gets us what we always talk about. I mean, that's your first challenge. If you start responding to your philosophic impulse, your seventh adjutant, right? Job number one is to build a bridle to put on your sixth adjutant, all right, and to get a hold of the reins, and stop thinking that you can just let that run wild like Abel's did. Not advised, right? It needs a governor. It's destined for great things, but it's not innately going to do that, right? So you need to manage that, and the more you have an environment that fosters that, you know, the easier it is for you to manage yourself in this regard. You know, and so Adam and Eve got it set up enough so that there was a home life for the violet peoples. Right? Not as fancy a home life as in the first garden, but enough so that they were stabilized and weren't flying off on tangents prior to being 30 years old.
And when thinking of the Sethite priesthood, do not confuse those high-minded and noble teachers of health and religion, those true educators, with the debased and commercial priesthoods of the lighter tribes and surrounding nations. Their religious concepts of deity and the universe were advanced and more or less accurate. Their health provisions were, for their time, excellent. And their methods of education have never been since been surpassed.
Have never since been surpassed. Yeah. Remember how they often remind us of how dependent we are on the normal dispensational revelations on a world to get decent education set up and maintained. That we don't self-initiate very well in that regard. So they're reminding that again. And there, of course, is, you know, when you think about all the foolishness in the Old Testament, right, debased and commercial priesthoods and all of this, you know, confusion about health stuff, you know, where it just becomes totally arbitrary and bizarre and, right, predicated on all sorts of random taboos and whatnot. You know, it doesn't really have any science to it at all, hardly anymore. No, it wasn't like that originally with the Sethite priesthood. Calling it the Sethite priesthood, using the word priest, is a challenge. First of all, naturally, as the revelators talk about when they talk about the evolution of religion, there's no way to escape it becoming debased, as they talk about in subsequent papers. You've got to meet the people where they are. But if you have over control of a priesthood, you know, if Adam and Eve hadn't defaulted and they were here maintaining an uplifting influence on that, it wouldn't have, you know, dropped so quickly to the debased shamanistic, you know, sort of phenomenon that it had, that was forever on this world. But eventually, you have to leave priests behind. Because as long as you have a priest tied to religion, as long as you have a religious authority tied to religion, that is falsely binding your concept of religion to the outer life. Right? Genuine religion is a purely inner life fact, you know, and that shaman or priest or pastor or minister or, you know, imam or whatever is a boat anchor that's dragging the concept of religion out into the outer life for you. You need to let go eventually. And it's a purely inner life fact. It doesn't involve cathedrals, priests, statues, incense, candles. Right? It's a pure inner life fact. It's not as it appears to us, and some outer fancy outer life thing, you know, and then gets in the face of other outer life things like science or government or, right? If it was genuine religion, you wouldn't have these contests, right? It's not really science's fault, it's religion's fault. You know, it's laying claim to a domain that it doesn't have a right to lay claim to, the external world. It's an inner life fact. Yeah. So But way back, okay, first and second dispensational revelations on any world are not going to be somehow trying to establish this, you know, no outer life religious concept. I mean, it starts in the outer life, but it has to ever steadily evolve into the inner life. And the fifth epical revelation is trying to really teach us that for the first time, right? Jesus is a guy in the outer life. Right? Muhammad is a guy in the outer life. Whoever, right? Some person in the outer life. That's not fundamentally religion. That's Jesusism or Mohammedanism or whateverism. Taking some, outer life thing and relating to it as if it was spiritual, as if it was an inner life fact, making it an ism.
Chris.
Yep.
Two things. Mm-hmm. Have you ever tried to unpack the mess of these methods of education that have been surpassed? They hint at them in various places. I mean,
well,
maybe partially from Dalmatia, where they talk a little bit about that.
The main thing, to start, what all of these methods are predicated on, the final paragraph in paper 16, section 6, right? You go back, and what does it say? It says, it is the purpose of education to develop and sharpen these innate endowments of the human mind. What innate endowments? The three cosmic intuitions, right? That, the details need to be tailored to the time and the people and the place, right? But you have to hold that up front. And no matter what you're doing in an educational setting, the whole purpose of it, right, is to develop and sharpen each student's cosmic insight. Right? It's not to give them technical details about soldering, or animal husbandry, or particle physics, or whatever.
Socialism.
Yeah, especially not some ism. Right. But see, that's, in Jesus, even if you think about it, Jesus taught you this, seek first the kingdom of heaven. Right? Educationally, see, seek first your insight in the kingdom within, not a sophistication of your sight in the external world.
That's not for agriculture, craftsmanship, and animal husbandry. That's very down to earth.
Sure, yeah, you're gonna do down to earth things, but first and foremost, no matter what you're teaching, the point is to get that student to engage, say, animal husbandry as a human,
right,
with insight.
I think it all comes together. It has to be done together.
You establish the inner life, and then you develop the mechanism to translate that well into the outer life so that your animal husbandry is predicated on the kingdom of heaven within. Right? Or whatever you're doing in the outer life.
They establish the inner life first. It doesn't seem easy to do that with a child.
But you start. See, again, it isn't some airy, fairy, sophisticated thing. And you certainly don't start the child out, okay, now there's three cosmic intuitions, and we're going to call the first. No, you don't start them out like that. Right? That's being scientific about it. You're not going to teach them the science of the three cosmic intuitions, the physics of the three cosmic intuitions. You're just going to try to awaken insight so that they can approach whatever it is that they're going to do in the outer life objectively. Right? You can actually get them up to a human level where they aren't just merely reacting to the environment. They're acting. Right, they're taking the initiative. They're being creative. Right, see, remember, if you don't seek first the kingdom of heaven, if it doesn't start with insight, No discipline will ever be creative. It'll be inventive, but it won't be creative. It has to be creative first. You have to discover genuine action rather than just inventive reaction, clever reaction. There's a lot of clever reactors. It's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch are creative actors. Right? And no one should have any immediate sense of what I'm talking about. That's very important. But you just have to know that there's something besides clever, you know, inventive, reactive mind. There's something that hasn't been written about much in human history because it hasn't been explored. And it's what the word creative actually applies to. It's what the word personality actually implies to. It's what the word insight actually applies to. Something unexplored and unwritten in general. A vast domain of human potential that has never been tapped. Right? A creative musician. Right? A creative shepherd. Right? Whatever. A creative paleontologist, and not just a clever rationalizer, a creative paleontologist, a creative geologist. What do those human scientists look like instead of just the fancy animal scientists? What would they be like?
It is kind of dark when you look out and look for evidence of this, because it appears anyway that the longer people are in our educational system, we're educating whatever cosmic intuition they have, educating it out of them.
Yep.
Rather than encouraging it.
Right.
So by the time they get through a higher, they've just.
Yeah. They're ready for therapy.
They're just indoctrinated.
I mean, think about how, in general, it's thought of as a very negative thing to label someone by saying, that person is not predictable. Okay, if they're predictable, they're not a person. A typewriter is predictable. You punch the M key and it makes an M on the page. That's predictable. Is that what we're trying to... Our educational institutions, are they trying to make fancy typewriters predictable machines? No. Being predictable means you're not even honestly a fancy animal. You're a fancy machine. See, but it says it's a term of derision. Boy, it's totally unpredictable. It's horrible. What? What? Right? No, that's called a human. Oh, but that's scary. Do you suppose that's why you should learn to trust? Right? We're frightened little animals that want to indoctrinate machines now in our institutions that are all predictable. You know exactly how they're going to respond to every stimulus. You know who every person they're going to vote for. You know, they're just machines. Right? They're not humans anymore. Right? But Adam and Eve, right? We're trying to produce humans. We're trying to mature human children. Right? Creative, spontaneous, free will beings can't be predicted. That are actually going to creatively add something new to the universe. Okay, something that not even the Ancients of Days or the Master Architects can predict. Right?
Who could have predicted Seth and his line and the what they chose to take on? I mean, I it boggles my mind. I can't imagine someone, a young person like Seth must have been, to embrace this responsibility and take it on like he did. I mean,
and change all of human history. I mean, like I said, I mean, we can't even begin to imagine what the world would be like if he hadn't responded like that to that stimulus, that unnatural response to that stimulus, that human response to that stimulus changed all of human history. And it made it human history. Okay. Other little thing there, just, you know, notice the subtle little things they throw in. Their religious concepts of deity, not their religious concepts of God. Just to remind you how sophisticated it was. Their religious concepts of deity and the universe were advanced and more or less accurate. And it's only now with the fifth epical revelation that they're attempting to get us back to what Adam and Eve are trying to instill, a difference between deity and God. Okay, so now we kind of move forward here.
Section 4, the violet race. Adam and Eve were the founders of the violet race of men, the ninth human race to appear on Urantia. Adam and his offspring had blue eyes, and the violet peoples were characterized by fair complexions and light hair color, yellow, red, and brown.
Okay, so apart from most likely the Nodites feeding in a little bit of this too, because after those 300,000 years before the rebellion, they were kind of modified into a quasi-Adamic genetics. So apart from that, the wild card kind of the Nodites, the only reason that there isn't nothing but black hair and black eyes on the planet is because of Adam and Eve. Right? That's where the non-black hair, black eyes comes from. You see the fair complexion. I mean, you just don't have that, everything being predicated on the Andonic, like it is here. Okay, so, so they do give you that one little hint about, and of course, anyone who knows the 20th century goes, oh, wait a minute, that sounds like you're getting kind of like those guys that used to run around the globe with the calipers looking for the long-headed peoples. And oh, I don't know, isn't that like Nazi? And looking for the blue eyes and the, okay. I mean, that's just, we have to face that, right? I mean, it isn't the ism, concepts in Nazism, right? But there's a validity to that, right? I mean, the only reason that you have anything on the planet, that they were fixating on is because of Adam and Eve. So there is a thread of truth that got twisted. Right, and what they did. And those are always the most problematic, right, things in human history. When you when you have someone getting some basic recognition of a little thread, but they either don't have the context to put it into, so it ends up getting twisted, or they have some self-serving agenda and they consciously twist it. Either way, it ends up getting twisted, but it has a sweeping consequence beyond what you might expect because it's predicated on something that has a slight reality response in you that you won't pick up consciously. Right? Why could the Nazis say some of the things they said and have it have the traction that it had? Because it's tweaking a little bit of a reality response. Like, wait a minute, I think there might, that feels like there's something to that. Right? Why is there that difference between northern and southern China, between northern and southern Italy, I mean, et cetera? What? You know, I think there's something there, right? You pick it, you know that there's a thread of truth buried somewhere in there. And if you aren't sophisticated, you swallow all the falsehood with that little thread of truth and run willy-nilly with the ism, right? It's, you know, it's a sophistry, see, right, in that sense, you know. We all know that, you know, that's a very mild example. We all know there's very strong examples in the book that lead a lot of unthinking people on this planet, you know, to call this, you know, the American Mein Kampf. Right? There's a reason why, you know, it has that derision and quarters on the world, right? Because of taking these things out of context and thinking that these are validating how those in the past have twisted truth. Right? No, it's trying to get rid of all the twisted crap and get you back to the thread and recognize why, you know, those thoughts can have such sweeping impact on people, why they just can't help themselves but to be, you know, captivated by some of these thoughts that you can throw out. Okay. All right. Okay, so that's where we got the whole fair complexions and blonde and red and brown hair and whatnot. Okay, what else?
Eve did not suffer pain in childbirth. Neither did the early evolutionary races. Only the mixed races produced by the union of evolutionary man with the Noddites and later with the Adamites suffered the severe pangs of childbirth.
Yeah, I think everyone kind of, I think we mentioned that one even a week or two ago. You know, that's a biggie that they throw in there. And you're left wondering about this. It's like, okay, so apparently the mixing of the Sangiks wasn't an issue. You know, and you think, well, is that because our Sangiks came from Andonites? Or is that true in general? That you can have mixing of Sangiks and you don't have pain in childbirth. And this whole bit of, okay, so it comes when Adam and Eve biologically feed in. Okay, now, well, is that just part of the process on every world? Or is that somehow managed, if it had been properly managed, instead of kind of just getting put out there like it did here, is there normally less pain in childbirth as you blend in the Adamic race? Maybe is it so well managed there never is any? I mean, is it so carefully, are the people so carefully lifted up rather than sort of haphazardly lifted up like they were here? I mean, it really gets you wondering. They don't explain, right?
I mean, we take it for matter of fact. That
there's pain in childbirth.
Yeah, but has anyone ever asked, well, why?
Oh, see, and the fact that
physiologically, why?
Yeah, and see, and to point out, it's a very subtle thing. It's because you have this vertical tension that's not resolved that got set up. You know, when it was horizontal before, but you throw in this vertical tension, right? You know, we've talked about how that's why Adam and Eve are not designed to mate directly, because the vertical tension is so extreme, you know, that it literally kills the mother in childbirth. You know, but we're not just talking about those that, you know, Adam and Eve directly mated with, right, or anything. I mean, we're just talking about all their children, you know, as they started to blend in, right? All of a sudden, you're spreading pain in childbirth all over the earth. It's very, yeah, fascinating. The physiology of that, right? To figure out what exactly is it, you know, that they did that led to that.
You get the sense that Adam and Eve understood it.
Right, I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They knew what he was sensing Laodicea
to. Yeah, and I'm sure all the kids knew that as they started mating with the evolutionary races, right, that there, you know, there would be pain in childbirth. being added in. I mean, you also can, you know, find peoples on the planet with very minimal Andite blood fed in, and there's a lot less pain in childbirth. You know, for some people, you know, it's just a very matter of fact thing. Squat down, birth the baby, and go on with your life. You know, it's just nothing. Anyway, you know, that's a kind of a zinger too. You know, see, that deserves its own little paragraph itself. You know, as they toss that out at you, it's like, whoa, what? Childbirth comes from this, you know. And like I said, then you're left just like, well, is it a consequence of the default, or just is it always that way with Adamic uplift? You don't, you know, they don't explain, so I don't know. They probably couldn't explain because it would be giving away something about the science of it, you know, the physics of it, that they're not allowed to tell us, and we have to figure that out ourselves. That's probably why they don't explain. all right.
Adam and Eve, like their brethren on Gerizim, were energized by dual nutrition, subsisting on both food and light, supplemented by certain superphysical energies unrevealed on Urantia. Their Urantia offspring did not inherit the parental endowment of energy intake and light circulation. They had a single circulation, the human type of blood sustenance. They were designedly mortals, though long-lived, albeit longevity gravitated toward the human norm with each succeeding generation.
So eventually you get to the 3 score year and 10, or by reason of strength, 4 score. But it did start out quite long. And here you see him, you know, touching back again in a little bit more precise way about what we unpacked before. You have this mysterious, what's most likely, like I told you, one of the living energies that is being called, quote-unquote, light here. And then, you know, as I say so often, you've got that, you know, whatever energies the master physical controllers in more direct sense are feeding in, you know, these physical energies unrevealed on Urantia, quote-unquote. Okay, we're not talking about electrical, you know, electric-level energies here. You know, boy, if we could only find that, and no, I mean, these are sub-electronic, right, energies, you know, that are being fed in. So that's the basic there. Let's see, what else do we have there? Just that, you know, we've pointed this out, you know, a number of times that, even though, like, especially that first generation had some things, obviously, a little bit above the norm. Adam and Eve don't reproduce and transfer any of this ability to tap in, use the Tree of Life, or any of that, right? Like we talked about, as they're pointing out there. I mean, Adamson, you know, even, for instance, you know, had the basic internal plumbing like you do. Okay.
There's something else going on, though, because even I'm getting the impression that even if there was, tried to maintain a pure line violet race, there still would have been this descent from Adam and Eve, but even subsequent generations, a descending phenomenon.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, not as much as this. I mean, there's a descent, but it plateaus.
Level out.
Okay. It continues, you know, because they're not just going to subsequent generations, but they're mating, you know, in with the evolutionary stock.
Right away?
Yeah. Yeah, very, very early on, they're mating in. So
they got 500,000.
Well, no, I mean, all those plans went out the window.
No, right? I thought he meant,
you know,
normally a billion.
Normally they would. You know, I mean, if they're right, I mean, if there hadn't been the default, right, they would have produced these vast numbers of pure line children.
Okay.
That would have, you know, they just come down and reach this level that properly blend, you know, is to be mated in. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't, con, you know, it, the, what they're talking about here is a blend of those two things. So you have that and mating in, and, you know, that brings it down to the 3 score year and 10, right?
They're biological uplifters.
Right, so right. See, they obviously, they can't innately drop all the way down to the biological level, or like John is just saying, logically, they wouldn't be uplifters then, right? You know, they have to plateau above the evolutionary stock to be an uplifter. It's just that Adam and Eve is too big of an uplift, you know, and you're even left wondering, it's like, well, it seems like on this planet anyway, the first generation still were a kind of a cut above. Maybe none of the first generation were supposed to mate, you know, with the evolutionary stock either, see. Maybe it was only, you know, second or third or generation on or something. You know, I mean, who knows what the original plan was. Because as we know, when we get to the next paper, Adamson is still able to, you know, be responsible for producing secondary midwares. That's probably not something that was supposed to be genetically blended into the stock. You know, not that, you know, the humans could produce secondary midwares, but, you know, there, that indicates an internal nature that's, okay, a little bit of cut above the evolutionary level. So, yeah. All right.
Adam and Eve and their first generation of children did not use the flesh of animals for food. They subsisted wholly upon the fruits of the trees, quote unquote. After the first generation, all of the descendants of Adam began to partake of dairy products, but many of them continued to follow a non-flesh diet. Many of the southern tribes with whom they later united were also non-flesh eaters. Later on, most of these vegetarian tribes migrated to the east and survived as now admixed in the peoples of India.
So there's that follow-up thing that we were talking about before. Where did we get these traditions that we have with vegetarian diets? And you also see, again, the first generation being differentiated from the subsequent generations, like we were just saying. They're just genetically not requiring animal-based proteins and stuff like the subsequent generations are need. And then the southern tribes you're talking about, remember, that's the Nodites that are down, you know, the pre-Sumerian Nodites that are down in the southern part of Mesopotamia there. So like I said, see, it's not just with Adam and Eve, but there is a tradition, see, going all the way back, again, to the uplifted genetics of the prince's staff that didn't need this either, right? Didn't have evolutionary stock dietary needs.
So in India, you know, a lot of the reasons why they don't eat meat is because of the transmigration of the souls in the animals. And so it seems that, you know, that may have been where it evolved to, but right. It started out in the other.
Yeah, yeah. They're pointing out that it didn't start out as some, you know, religious notion of sacred cows. You know, or any other sacred animal, right? But it all gets blended in and re-rationalized and, you know, and then continued on, and yeah. You know, you can see even that subsequent to the first generation, they're indicating some desires like, well, you know, I think I want to continue the non-flesh diet because I want to sort of do it as a demonstration of you know, how much I respect Adam and Eve and, you know, and what we're doing. See, so it's already starts to take on this kind of false exaltation a bit, you know. It starts kind of innocently. It's like, well, it's a family tradition, but, you know, after a few generations, it gets exalted, right?
If the book catches on, I'll bet it will again.
Yeah, right? I mean, yeah, yeah. And again, none of that is bad or anything. It's just, you know, it's just important to kind of think objectively about why we do the things we do and not falsely existentialize this stuff, right? All right.
Both the physical and spiritual visions of Adam and Eve were far superior to those of the present-day peoples. Their special senses were much more acute, and they were able to see the Midwares and the angelic hosts, the Melchizedeks and the fallen Prince Caligastia, who several times came to confer with his noble successor. They retained the ability to see these celestial beings for over 100 years after the default. These special senses were not so acutely present in their children and tended to diminish with each succeeding generation.
Okay. Now, if you're not, I mean, I don't know how many people are familiar with that technical term of special senses, so that you aren't overplaying that. I mean, that has nothing to do with the Urantia book. Right? That's just a term. You have five senses, four of which are special senses. Seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, because there's special organs in your body for those senses. And then you have one general sense, touch, right? That's just related to the normal somatic nerve, phenomenon. Right? There's no special organ for that. Right? The special senses are seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing. Okay? So, so that's what they're talking about. They don't have a different sense of touch, but they have a different sense of sight. Right? And their sight goes beyond just, we, with our special senses and these special organs, they're attached to making them special senses in the first place. We think of those in such physical terms, but again, remember, no sense is material. All senses are mindal. Right? Your eyeballs don't see anything. Your ears don't hear anything. Right? Your mind sees things. Your ears hear things. Right? All of your senses are in your mind. Right? And you have some physical phenomenon that is translated into a representation into mind, translated by deity into your mind, where you sense it. And as we know, studying your universe career, for instance, right? You'll have a lot more ways of getting a representation in your mind that you sense as sight. Ways of getting it into your mind that go beyond the very literal eyeball thing that you know about right now.
In your mind, through your brain, though.
Yes and no. The higher you go, the less you need some sort of physical complement.
Here on Earth, though.
Right, here on Earth, right, we all know that, we follow all the special organs, for the ears or the eyes or whatever, to the brain. Okay, but then how does it get from the brain to the mind? Eventually, you begin to transcend. It doesn't need to get to the brain at all. It doesn't need to get to eyeballs, right? It can just go from the environment to the mind. Again, it's like, well, how's it going to do that? Sounds magical. Well, how does it get from your brain to your mind? That sounds pretty magical too, doesn't it? Yeah, right? Without deity, it is magical, right? They don't give us any of the physics here, but they just, right, there are sight representations in their mind that go beyond those sight representations that are limited by eyeballs, right? None of this has anything to do with, they can see farther into the ultraviolet or the infrared. No, it has nothing to do with the electromagnetic spectrum or anything. It's not in that sense that they're, maybe they had... You could imagine they might have that a little bit too, but that has nothing to do with being able to see a midwayer, right? That if only I could see into the X-ray, I could see a midwayer. No, it has nothing to do with that. Okay, in a simple way of thinking about it, that electromagnetic spectrum is horizontal, and the midwayers are vertically separated, not horizontally separated from you in sight. You need a deeper depth of sight, not a wider breadth of sight to see them. Okay? And Adam and Eve and their children, like we talked about that some before, it's obvious that especially the first generation, you can imagine, has some, you know, they sense some of the celestial beings as well. We don't know if the first generation, you know, we've talked about this, can they see as high up the hierarchy here, like all the way up to Lenana Dex? You know, when we talked about this, well, yeah, it kind of sounds like maybe, because they're talking, you know, talking about Dalagastia, and yeah, we remember we talked about that some before. But that's what they're, so they're just getting back to that and reminding you that that's one of these things that is there in the beginning but fades away, just like the longevity is there in the beginning and fades away. So, unlike cultivated grains or weaving that go all the way forward, these are some things that aren't going to literally go all the way forward, but they're going to go forward mythologically, right? So that you have, you know, the genealogy in the Bible, you know, having people live a long time.
So could Jesus see angelic beings?
No. See, he couldn't. I mean, you know,
unless they manifest.
The master physical controllers, you know, would make them visible to him. You know, like Satan and Galagashia, you know, were made visible to him. See, because again, he's just, you know, he's limited just like we are, you know, in that regard. But we all know they tell you that through all that advanced genetic engineering that's going to go on, you know, you can see here, you don't normally get it by a biologic uplift, but you go way forward towards light and life with genetic engineering, and eventually you have mortals, right, that can actually see the lower celestial beings. See it, again, see, because they have this greater depth, right?
And hear them, maybe, right?
Yeah, see, and that's the other thing. I mean, okay, so how about, you know, they just talk about kind of seeing, because that's kind of the starting point, but how much is there, you know, the other, you know, three smells, you know, is there any smelling, tasting, you know, hearing, you know, or what, yeah. Right.
Does it have something to do with, how can you think of it, like, how, as we go through the mansion worlds and on, we get these upgraded bodies and minds.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have to have that to be able to go on.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we not only get it as you go up, but like I'm pointing out, you know, a world gets it as it goes forward in a light life. You know, and just what I was just saying, that reminds you of, I mean, if Jesus, you know, the Jesus of 2,000 years ago was put on a world in light life, he would not be allowed, you know, he'd be put in a hermetically sealed bottle, right? I mean, beings on a world in light and life are so advanced genetically and everything relative to Jesus 2,000 years ago, right? Jesus, you know, didn't have a 500-year lifespan or, you know, anything like that, okay? He's very limited genetically. I mean, that's why his life is so relevant, that he's not the genetics of a light and lifer. He's the genetics of us, right? And it's just a reminder that it's sad to record that you aren't, you know, pushing above your genetic limitations, right? That you're just resting on your genetics and hence are limited by it. You don't have to be as limited by your genetics as it appears. Jesus demonstrates that. Okay, you're not going to go as fast and as far as Jesus did because you don't have as experienced an adjuster as he does, okay? But, you know, you don't have to be the blob of protoplasm that most people on this planet are. You could be, you know, taking delight in cultivating. You could be using the insights, right? You can strive for the third circular Jesus. You can strive for the Jesus around the Mediterranean. That's completely within your potential to strive for that, to be that kind of an insightful, a wise, insightful, foresightful human.
So it's more about spiritual wise mind.
Right, that spiritualized mind, right? That personal self, right? That self that is has a presence that is not caught off guard, right? Jesus is always just right there as he's going around the Mediterranean to just brilliantly respond to whatever comes at him, right? To have that incredible presence in the moment, to say just the proper helpful thing, you know, or whatever. Right? It's because he's a human, right? And not he can act in advance. He's not just reacting. Right? He's present in an objective way in a situation. Right? That's not because he's God. It's because he's. Yeah, it seems so godlike, see, because that's just how lowly we are, right? I mean, a third circler appears to be a god to us. Imagine what Adam and Eve would, how we'd respond to them. You know, you'd be prostrating yourself wanting to worship them too, right? Right, cause, you know, they make third circler Jesus look like nothing, right?
They'd have to correct us for...
I mean, it's just, that's what, you know, the pre-baptismal Jesus is such a, to have that restored to us, such an incredible gift, right? It's not the life of teaching, the life and teachings of Michael that's helpful to you, right? Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus, the man. Okay, not Michael, the God, that's of no use to you. But in what sense am I saying that, right?
Well,
you can't, you know, it's totally a false thing. It's like, I have to be like that. You can't be like that. That's a creator.
It's probably not.
It's of no practical use. Sure, it's wonderful for, you know, to strike your idealism towards, right, but not your ideas, right?
He's still someone I have a relationship with, so.
Again, Michael is an inspiration, right?
Right.
Right.
Just to clarify.
Right, right.
But Jesus is a rebel.
Right, you see, but Jesus the man, right, the fourth epical revelation is not Michael of Nebadon.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's Jesus of Nazareth. That's the official title given in this book, you know, for the fourth epical revelation. It's not his teachings. Right? Like the first two epical revelations, it's the teachings. The fourth is not his teachings. Right? He's the revelation. Jesus the man. Jesus of Nazareth. Not Jesus of Galilee, you know, or whatever, you know, in his public teaching. Right? But Jesus of Nazareth, that human... His human faith, that's the revelation, the faith of Jesus. That's how the book ends. That's the fourth epical revelation. That faith is a revelation. He revealed human faith rather than fancy animal belief. That's the revelation. You can see what kind of fruits genuine faith has, in contrast to what kind of fruits you can see all around you every day that come from credulous belief. And you can consider the contrast between the fruits of credulous belief and the fruits of genuine faith. And it should strike you as different. If it doesn't, okay. There's the first mansion rule. That's the whole point.
Michael and Jesus. Like, I like to think of Michael as my beloved sovereign. And I like to think of it as Michael.
And see, and there you're hitting on it, that genuine word love, right? Purely in the inner life. And what's the definition in 16:6 of love? The personal realization of divine fellowship. Okay? Mm-hmm. Yes. Michael, right? Okay? You can engage Michael, or the master son now even, more than merely a Michael, right? In divine fellowship, there can be a personal realization of that divine fellowship. Yes.
Yes. So when you say
that's it.
You're not going to get anything from him.
What was I talking about for that? I wasn't talking about the inner life. I was talking about the outer life. Right?
But it always strikes a chord that I I just love that relationship so much.
Yeah.
So it always strikes that chord when you say something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And see, and all, I mean, I purposely set up that tension.
Right, and I reacted to it.
Right, so that you could think about the difference between feelings and love. Right, you don't want to. You want to have a love relationship with Michael. Right, in the upper domain, above feelings.
But there's right? always feelings that come as a result of it.
Sure.
So it's not. It's right. never totally separate. Like
yeah,
that.
Right. But see, but you have to seek first what's above the feelings, and then let the feelings which naturally happen, right? But again, right. Jesus told you, don't seek the feelings first, because then you'll be seeking the feelings last. Seek what's above the feelings first, and you'll get the feelings that are so pleasant. They'll be there. You won't have to generate them or something by some fancy scheme you've dreamt up. They'll naturally come. But they'll be predicated on something much more important, much more significant to your life than feelings. A personal realization of divine fellowship, a genuine love.
A reason to clarify that whole thing is because I notice some people think, I have to be above feelings. You can't do it like that.
No, you're not going to be. Doesn't mean you're divorced from feelings, right?
But they think that, so yeah. I tend to like to clarify.
Because we always respond in dichotomies, right? And you just have to stop yourself from doing that. Yeah.
But I see people going down that rabbit hole a lot, especially with your teachings. So I tend to like to clarify it.
Yeah. See, all I'm trying to do is just try to set up that initial tension that there's something above feelings, even though it doesn't appear there is, it appears it's the ceiling. It appears there's feelings, nothing more than feelings. We write songs with those lyrics because that's the appearance, but it's not the reality, right? The revelation is here to say that's not the reality, right? There's something above feelings that you can't see, but you should see if you can be grown up to the space where that is. By letting and you can't be grown up to there unless you let go of feelings as the apex experience.
As the apex, right.
See?
Maybe I should let people figure it out.
Did you have something?
Oh, did you have a question?
Another point of clarification. Like, it seems like we're focusing on, between discussing the man Jesus and his life and the example he sets. And then also previously, I'm a little lost. I probably should have asked him earlier. But there's this idea that these are the high. There are examples of people who do have moments of faith, I think. And I was wondering if that's allowed. The other one is creativity. I think there's fleeting. It perhaps isn't the astounding musical number that turns the whole world to peace. But there's little moments we can still.
Yeah. Again, every one of us, by grace, has love, faith, right, creativity, superconsciously, and there are occasional shadows that are cast down from those real facts. And when people manifest the fruits from that shadow, you can notice. If you're aware of the higher potential. Go, I don't think that was just merely a feelingful service there. I think that was actually a loving service. Even if the person wasn't conscious of it, I think you can follow that feeling back up to a love source. My insight is suspicious here, right? That this is a deeper, this fact has a deeper origin than merely feelings. All I'm challenging. I'm not saying we aren't by grace children of God, right? But it's sad to record that we don't have much of a conscious record. The fact that I can't look up love in the dictionary, I can't look up faith in the dictionary, right? I can use my insight and go, the dictionary says that faith is credulous belief. Okay, but I can also know that there's occasional individuals that go, oh, that person just has credulous belief. It's like, well, no, not really. It appears that way. It appears they have a belief that's not based on anything that you recognize as valid basis for a belief. And so you're labeling that belief credulous, you know, devoid of proof. See, there's a truth to the definition, the false definition, if you will, or the improper definition of faith in the dictionary is credulous belief. Because, see, faith is not a belief. It's the validating mechanism. And it could be an unseen fact above, you know, behind the belief that you see. If all you can see is the belief, and so it will appear to be without validation. But it might really have a validation of genuine faith behind it if you have the insight to penetrate through the belief and recognize that, like I was just saying. Okay, so. But, you know, the dictionary doesn't say faith is a validating mechanism that leads to a belief that appears to not have a basis, but it really does. That is what the dictionary says. It just says, see, it's the two-dimensional belief. See? Okay. Reason, logic, faith are three validating mechanisms. Right, that they're trying to get you to recognize that it exists behind things. That there's even that very low-hanging one of saying that something is rational, yes, but it's a little bit more than that. It's also reasonable. In other words, it's some sort of rationale that's validated. And you could say even more. Not only is it rational... You did the dot with the second adjutant, okay? But it's reasonable. It's got that initial linear validation, if you will, behind it. But I can say it's even more than that. It's logical. It's validated holistically, non-linearly. You have these validating mechanisms, again, that you can't look up the definitions of in the dictionary. Right, that we haven't consciously recognized there's these three validating mechanisms, and they're not, so we don't have an expression of that fact in our dictionary. But there really are these three validating mechanisms, and your belief might not be just an arbitrary thing that you've pulled out of thin air, even though it'll appear to everyone to believe. You know, when you do something very objectively, like Jesus would. It was so out of the norm to behave like a human instead of a fancy animal that they thought he was beside himself. And like I was saying earlier, right, we talk derisively about someone that demonstrates even the most limited human quality, you know, basically indicating that they're crazy, right? They're deranged, there's something wrong with them. This person's not predictable. Like I said, I mean, just trivial, basic things of a human. Right, that you can't predict them, that they're creative, that they're original, unlike typewriters. Okay, every time Jesus did something, see, that was human, it struck everyone as just this person is out of his mind. Right? Yeah. Nothing has really changed, see, from those times. If you were to manifest as a definitive third circler, you would be labeled as beside yourself. That's just so unnatural what you're doing. That means you're a crazy person. Right? That's what we think unnaturalness is some sort of derangement of the mind. It's like, well, yeah, if you go down, but you can go up. There's a transcendent lying unnaturalness that is your humanity. Right?
Some would define that as being a wild duck.
Right, there's that bit of, right, when someone generates a little bit of originality, right, in business circles, they might call them a wild duck. Notice that they call them wild, see? See, it's just, I mean, we have a hard time not having kind of a little hint of, I don't know, you know, this person's a little bit weird, a little bit uncontrolled, you know, a little wild, right?
But it's encouraged.
Right, it should be encouraged, because it's human. Okay, meanwhile, back to Adam and Eve. Okay, so we did, let's see, where did we leave off? Okay, we did the special senses. I guess we're ready for the adjuster, right?
Well, yeah.
Is there a question or something?
Well, they seem to suggest that for Adam and Eve, the acuteness was kind of attenuating over time.
Yeah, right, you noticed that, right? See, that eventually they couldn't see Kalagashi anymore. Right, or the angels, or anyone else. Yeah, I mean, in Kalagashi's case, it's like, finally, I can't hear him anymore. Yeah. Thank God. Just a yappy little dog for 200 years now, right?
But it's a post-default morphology of some sort going on.
Well, yeah, remember, they, they're immediately unplugged, in a number of things. But there's, there are material mechanisms, so there's inertia, right? But it's there's friction, right? And so it slowly grinds the gears and fades away. Yeah.
The Adamic children were usually adjuster indwelt, since they all possessed undoubted survival capacity. These superior offspring were not so subject to fear as the children of evolution. So much of fear persists in the present-day races of Urantia because your ancestors received so little of Adam's life plasm, owing to the early miscarriage of the plans for racial physical uplift.
Okay, you had another little, each of these paragraphs is a little tidbit. Two things there. Let's deal with the fear part first. Okay, so in the same spirit that they've been giving us these tidbits, like child pain and childbirth. Okay, there's another one. That's how significant the biologic uplift would have been. That most of that animal origin fear would be below you if we've been uplifted. Think about how much different the evolution of religion would have been, right? If it at all doesn't go back to the fear of the Lord. For instance, and of course we've talked about this. What does that technically mean? It doesn't mean literally that you are bounded up above that energy that you now feel as fear. It just means genetically your mind is such that mind gets a hold of that energy, and you have focus instead of fear. So, religion predicated on focus instead of on fear. A life predicated on focus instead of fear. Think how much more of an actor instead of a reactor you would be then. How much more just naturally human you would be then.
Endemic children were usually...
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know. Being one of the first ones.
So he wants to immediately leave the whole fear thing behind and get to the other thing there. Yeah, that's the other issue. You notice that. See, we're usually... Right? So again, like I said, you got to wonder about Abel. And then you think about, right, that Adam and Eve need to get themselves... with their chin held up again. They need to get that spiritual gravity within, get themselves back up, and more humanly stabilized so that, there's that mental engagement of their biologic children, right? And so they can get the adjusters, naturally, all that stuff we talked about, you can see, would be involved in this. But you also, like I said, you can't dismiss that there may be something along the lines of where you have to taper from, you know, forget about a world where there isn't a default, from an Adam and Eve that are ongoing without adjusters, right, for endless millennia, and children that do have an adjusters, you know, just like they've talked about these ramps down, maybe it takes a few generations to get to the point where they can naturally get an adjuster at age 6 because their parents have an adjuster. Maybe, you know, early on it's a little bit delayed. And, you know, we talked about that. That might feed into why Abel also, you know, didn't have an adjuster, you know, not just his parents being depressed. So, you know, we're just guessing, but it kind of feels that way a little bit here more again. All right. And then let's see. All right, yeah, I guess we got everything else there. Yeah, the other stuff is just about the fear. Okay, so what else do we have in this regard of this physical uplift?
The body cells of the material sons and their progeny are far more resistant to disease than are those of the evolutionary beings indigenous to the planet. The body cells of the native races are akin to the living disease-producing microscopic and ultra-microscopic organisms of the realm. These facts explain why the Urantia peoples must do so much by way of scientific effort to withstand so many physical disorders. You would be far more disease-resistant if your races carried more of the Adamic life.
Okay, so we touched on that back in the Overcontrol of Evolution before. Just reminding you again here that, you know, this very stark fact that, you know, I often toss out, you know, that we're behaving merely like fancy animals instead of humans. Well, this is a reminder, biologically, if only you were a fancy animal, right? You're so subject to bacteria and viruses because you're just a fancy plant. All right, that's the really, like, oh, that's low, that's harsh. Okay, you're calling me pond scum now. Right?
Not my best
friend.
A lot of animals don't seem to pick up the diseases.
Yeah. Right, remember they tell you before, it's like, this is a vegetable level of salt that's being, you know, it's your, so, yeah, we need the biologic uplift. You know, so that our, you know, our feet aren't down there, you know, being subject to the plant level and its vicissitudes so much, right? Get our feet up, you know, and actually be more of an animal origin human instead of a plant origin human. Okay, to have, so no wonder it's so difficult to be, to have human with an animal origin foundation, you know. Right now, we're a plant with an animal, you know, built upon it. You know, yeah, we need to see, it needs to be moved up to the next notch in the hierarchy.
It's a scientific effort, which we're behind on that.
Right, right. But boy, we're a lot better than we were a couple hundred years ago with bacteria. Right. Now, of course, our ism tendency is bringing it back around. It's like, well, you know, if a little bit of antibacterial is good, I mean, we should make it a complete lifestyle solution. I should bathe in it every morning, and right, and yeah, you know, and so now all the bacteria are resistant to antibiotics, and
yeah, we go in the grocery store, and whoever heard of that, where you wipe your hands on the antibiotics.
Yeah, and they're misting you with it, and you know, and you know, it's just right. You know, it's a total. See, that's what the sixth adjutant does to the discovery of antibiotics, right? Yeah, wouldn't it be great if we had a bridle on that, right? So that, you know, antibiotics would still be effective like they were originally, instead of now we're grasping to try to come up with science that can get us something that still works. And, you know, what if no antibiotics work anymore? Okay, then we're really going to be drugged back down to the plant level.
That is happening. I mean, yeah. Infections
can
be so tricky.
Yeah, it's because, yeah, we turned it into a religion, right? And and killed ourselves with it.
And add a seed this afternoon. Okay, you know, they're spraying the kid's backpack. You know,
yeah. Like I said, I mean, it's just like, yeah, you walk into a store, you know, or something, and they're misting you with it, and it's like, stop. Everything's got antibacterial in it, and yeah. We're ridiculous like this.
Don't say that anymore because they are going to start misting.
Okay.
Plants like misting.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But on the positive side, a fancy plant is above a typewriter.
And they're prettier.
And they're prettier. Yeah. There you go. Okay. All right. What else do we have here?
After becoming established in the second garden on the Euphrates, Adam elected to leave behind as much of his life plasm as possible to benefit the world after his death. Accordingly, Eve was made the head of a commission of 12 on race improvement. And before Adam died, this commission had selected 1,682 of the highest type of women on Urantia. And these women were impregnated with Adamic life plasm. These children all grew up to maturity except 112, so that the world in this way was benefited by the addition of 1,570 superior men and women. Though these candidate mothers were selected from all the surrounding tribes and represented most of the races on Earth, the majority were chosen from the highest strains of the Noddites, and they constituted the early beginnings of the mighty Andite race. These children were born and reared in the tribal surroundings of their respective mothers.
Okay, so this is one of the most fascinating things. You know, in a book, because, you know, think about what's going on between the lines there. You know, talked about, they were mentioning metalworking, you know, and we lost that and had to rediscover metalworking. Okay, you know what we're talking about here. We're talking about artificial insemination, and they are obviously modifying the, you know, life plasm, quote unquote, so that, you know, the mothers don't die in childbirth. And when we're talking some genetic engineering that they're doing here, I mean, they've got to have some labs and lab equipment for such things. I mean, what are they? Yeah, this is some pretty interesting stuff. And, you know, there's even some curious things that you can find in old Sumerian, you know, reliefs and stuff, you know, where you're suspicious that they're depicting Adam and Eve, you know, and stuff that looks like some sort of technology, right? Yeah, I mean, this is just very interesting, that they're doing that level of sophisticated stuff. You know, remember, it's like, and so, you know, how did they get all of their children, you know, dematerialized and enseraphimed and taken off the planet? You know, a few pages back when we were reading that, I mean, that takes some serious, you know, lab setup, right? You know, they've got a sophisticated lab on Gerasim where they dematerialize those. Oh, you know, that's, you know, so, okay.
This is
some interesting stuff, right? I mean,
what were they? I want to know.
Yeah,
they had crude materials.
Yeah, well, you know, we start with crude raw materials today too, but right? I mean, what exactly was required for them to do this? And I mean, you know, did they get some assistance here? Did the Melchizedeks, you know, say, okay, you know, we'll help you with that effort? You know, I mean, did they do this all by themselves? Is just this Adam and Eve? I mean,
yeah, it'd be like Data from Star Trek. I'm putting something together, and, you know, it's because they have the intelligence to do that. They could easily have created that. You know, I mean
they
have to have a big steel mill to create steel.
They
could have, you know.
Anyway.
Generate electricity, they knew how to do all that.
Just making sure, you know, you're not just engaging this with your mystical tendencies. They didn't, you know, wave some magic wand here. I mean, this is some serious science we're talking about and technology we're talking about here.
They had knowledge.
Right?
He
didn't have sex with any of these women, right? I mean, this is all obviously, see, you know, these are test tube babies. And modified genetics at that. It's really interesting. You think about the between the lines there. And apparently all successful in terms of getting born. It's just the vicissitudes of life. You know, 112 of them, you know, died because, you know, the hordes descended on the village or whatever, right? You know, but so yeah, and you're going, whoa, well, 1570, that's a lot bigger number than like 400. Right, the children that weren't taken away. Okay, this is a very significant input to what biologic uplift we got because they did this little science experiment here. You add that to the 400. Yeah, you add that to the 400 and the Noddites. And
so Eve got her wish.
Yeah, see, they ended up, actually doing this, you know. Like, yeah, well, we've already, that's water under the bridge, you know.
It's still a fancy
plan. But yeah, you know, you can just imagine what kind of, I mean, this would have been a very magical thing, you know, for the evolutionary peoples. That's what I was saying. It would be surprising if we couldn't dig around in like Sumerian stuff and find some hint. Right, of them remembering genetic engineering, you know, back in the past. And it's pretty interesting stuff. So, you know, and again, it reminds you of what Adam and Eve would have done, you know, scientifically for us. That's supposed to be their job, to teach people advanced science.
Commission of 12.
Yeah. Think about how much genetic engineering there would have been on this planet if there hadn't been a default and we had full scientific knowledge 10,000 BC, right? We had 12,000 years now of, you know, advanced genetic engineering that had been going on. You know, not only humans, but every plant and animal on the planet now would have been completely re-engineered in the last 12,000 years. It would be just a totally different planet if there hadn't been a default.
It would have blown our opportunity.
Okay.
And we wouldn't be plants anymore.
Yeah. There wouldn't be little Jesus of Nazareth, right? That genetics would have been long gone, right? Think about how different the Bestowal mission would have everything would have been totally different. Yeah, it may not have been the seventh Bestowal here at all. All those things.
It's been so long.
It's been so different.
Why the specificity on these numbers? It's just curious.
They do that a lot. Yeah, I mean, they're.
Will they tell you how many angels there are?
Well, yeah. Here, though, you know, this actually gives science a solid number where you could. You know, we're getting quite sophisticated now in calculating genetic consequences and this sort of stuff. You know, so they're giving you some, a solid little data point there, feeding in. Now, the mystery, that's the 1570. Why did Eve and her commission pick 1682? I don't know. Maybe they've, you know, searched far and wide, you know, and that was that's the number they ended up with, or maybe they're still looking, but now Adam is too old, his genetic quality is too degraded, and they, you know, I mean, I'm sure there had to be some point when they couldn't even do this anymore, because you know he's aging, you know, his genetics is diminishing, and
one question.
Yep.
Do you think this, what we were just talking about,
mm-hmm.
contributed more to the Caucasian peoples coming about?
No, I mean, not any direct, you know, remember, all this does, like they were just saying there, this just feeds into the beginning of the Andites. You know, and so no matter where you go on the planet, anywhere there's Andite influence, this feeds into northern China. You know, this is going to feed up to, you know, the group that Adamson is setting up, and hence that's going to feed into the Mediterranean and Greece and, you know, Crete and whatnot. You know, it's going to wrap back around and feed into northern Europe, you know, and the Andites go into there. And it feeds into all the Andite influence, because this is all the way back, see, at the beginning. So, you know, it's not going to be geographically limited to just the northern white race. Those very quote-unquote Caucasian-looking mummies, right? You know, in northern China there, right? Those are Andites. Those aren't Caucasians. Those are Andites. You know, and they're tied back to this genetics. Let's see. All right, I think, that's a really fun paragraph. Oh, just the other one little thing I wanted to mention. See, remember how we were thinking about the geography, right? You have, right now you've got Baghdad on the Tigris, right? Kind of right up there in the neck where the two rivers come together. You know, we're, like I've said, this is, you know, a little south, and on the Euphrates side, I should be doing it the other way, I suppose, from your perspective, right? This is farther south and on the Euphrates side. You know, like I said, you know, roughly where the city-state of Babylon was in the ancient past is where the second garden was. You know, so they're giving you that, you know, that again there. And then next we'll get into, you know, the end of the story with Adam and Eve here. You know.
Commission was constituted, but those have been...
Kids. Oh, wait, what was that?
Her commission of 12.
Yeah. I mean, you have to kind of chuckle. It's like, okay, so Adam, so you want to spread your genetics around. Yeah, I'm going to put you in charge, Eve, so it'll all be fine, right? Yeah, you have to kind of chuckle at the between the lines there. Going to sow a little wild oats here, Eve, and you're going to be cool with it because you're going to be leading the commission. So that's a pretty funny little between the lines there, too.
Yeah, but it's a test tube thing, so big
deal. So, sorry, honey. We're going to do it a different way.
But again, you know, it reminds you. I mean, they're so completely matter-of-fact about such matters. That's why you could do. That's why the default thing could happen in the first place, because they don't have all these taboo notions and whatnot in their head about this. And it's all very matter-of-fact. Okay. Anyway, so yeah, we'll get into the final chapter for Adam and Eve, and then we'll pick up, you know, on these going forward stories that they're so hinting at. You know, as I've been pointing out, you know, that story, that untold story, that is so interesting, how you end up with these mysterious beginnings at the dawn of recorded history. I mean, that's just, you know, the whole story of the Andites is just so fascinating. You know, it's the explanation for every weird thing that we find these days that doesn't fit into the current dogmas of human history, you know. These curious megalithic things and curious artifacts and, you know, the stuff we find. That's all, the answer to all that is the Andites. So it's fun stuff. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.